From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Daniel H. Pink is the author of five books, including New York Times bestseller Drive and A Whole New Mind. His latest is called To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Welcome to Craft, Daniel H. Pink.
Hey, Doug.
Tell me about this book in which you argue that it's not just one in nine people in the United States that are in sales, but in fact, all the eight of the other folks are in sales as well.
Right. So two ideas that animate this book. The first, as you say, is that, like it or not, we're all in sales. If you look at what people do each day on the job, whether they're teachers or nurses or accountants, they're spending a huge portion of their time trying to persuade, influence, convince other people, trying to sell them an idea, trying to sell them in a way of doing things, trying to influence, cajole, convince people. So one idea is that, like it or not, we're all in sales. Now, the second idea is that most people don't like that. They think of sales as sleazy and lowbrow and duplicitous. And I think that's an outdated view. Sales has changed more in the last 10 years than in the previous 100 because of changes in information. Most of what we know about sales has come from a world where the sellers have a lot more information than the buyers. When the sellers have a lot more information than the buyers, the sellers can rip you off. But we don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world where buyers and sellers are evenly matched. And so the two animating ideas are that, one, like it or not, we're all in sales. Two, sales isn't what it used to be. We've gone from a world of information asymmetry to information parity. And so the rest of the book describes what do you do about it. And I'm trying to give readers some really solid evidence-based, social science-based tools and tips for how they can get better at selling themselves, selling their idea, selling their class on paying attention, selling their patients on adhering to medicine, selling their colleagues on doing something different, selling their employees on doing things in a different way.
You know, one of the things that struck me about the book as I was reading, and maybe this is because I have a background in rhetoric, it is a lot about persuasion that you've categorized as non-sales selling. You know, selling your idea, selling
right.
the idea. And I thought that was interesting because I could see a lot of the older persuasion ideas at play in the background on the book. Although I have to tell you, one of my favorite chapters is the improvisation chapter, number 8, because
yeah.
You go out and have to do some of the improvisation techniques, including standing really close to somebody else and paying attention to them. Tell me about that aspect of going out and getting really close to people and trying to understand them from their point of view.
Yeah, one of the important skills today, again, in this broad definition of sales, is improvisation. You know, in the old days, sales, talking about traditional sales, was very scripted. In fact, the first sales scripts actually were out of Dayton, National Cash Register Corporation. Back in the old days, they would have these very elaborate scripts for their sales force selling cash registers, telling them exactly what to say, telling them where to point at certain moments. That form of sales has, now that buyers can get a lot more information on their own, that is waning. And what's more important are the skills of improvisation, that is, non-scripted kinds of responses. And for that, there's general principles that apply. Things like saying yes and. Rather than arguing with people. So instead of yes, but, you say yes and, which ends up being much more constructive, building on ideas. There's another principle of hearing offers, which I think is really powerful. Anytime you try to persuade somebody and they respond, even if they're saying no, embedded in there somewhere is an offer. And then the final one is making your partner look good. When two improvisational actors are on stage, if you and I are improvisational actors and we're on stage together, my job is to make you look good. Your job is to make me look good. And those mm-hmm. principles actually end up being very effective in persuading other people. Now, where the close proximity comes in is that one of the exercises that I learned in this improvisational training was listening to somebody, positioning myself very, very, very close to their face, and then waiting 15 seconds before responding. And it's excruciating. We're not used to doing that. But 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 one of the most important skills in any kind of persuasion effort these days is the ability to listen. And one way to enhance our ability to listen is to slow down, to not try to jump in right away. And I think what's interesting about the power of listening is that when we go to school, you learn how to read, you learn how to write, but no one ever teaches you how to listen. We have two ears so we can hear, but no one ever teaches us how to listen. And some explicit training in listening can go a very long way in being more persuasive.
Now, have you attempted to use any of these techniques in a non-sales selling experience, like, say, at home, trying to convince, I think at some point you said, your kids, to your 9-year-old to take a shower after a baseball game? Has the 15-second waiting been successful in those moments?
You know what? On that one, if I waited 15 seconds on that one, he'd escape. So I can't really use that technique for that one. But there are some. I'll tell you one that I think is really, really powerful. It's a technique known as motivational interviewing. It's a technique I learned from a guy named Michael Pantalon at Yale University. And it involves using questions to persuade people. And so here's what it would be. So suppose that I had a daughter, a 14-year-old daughter, whose room was always a mess. And I wanted her to clean her room.
I'm on board with you, by the way. I'm completely on board with you.
Not because I have any great aesthetic taste, but because, you know, she can't find stuff, and she ends up being late for school.
Right.
And, you know, it's a hassle. So how do I persuade her to clean up her room? Well, I could try to coerce her. I could try to bribe her. I could try to threaten her. And those might have a modest short-term effect. But motivational interviewing suggests that I'd be better off with asking two seemingly irrational questions. So what I would do is I would say to my daughter, let's call her Maria. I don't want to use the name of my actual daughter. So let's say I had a daughter named Maria. I would say two questions. Number one, Maria, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not ready at all, 10 being ready to do at this moment, on a scale of 1 to 10, how ready are you to clean your room? Now, Maria, you know, isn't cleaning her room, so she's going to pick a pretty low number. So she'll say, you know, let's say she's a 2. She's a dad, I'm a 2 on a scale of 0 to, on a scale of 1 to 10. All right, so that's question one. The follow-up question, though, is really where you have the action. So I say, okay, Maria, you're a 2. Why didn't you pick a lower number? You know, that always freaks people out. Why didn't you pick a lower number? And so what happens is that Maria has to say, I'm basically asking her, why aren't you a 1? You said you're a 2. Why aren't you a 1? And so what happens there is Maria has to say, well, you know, I'm 14. I know I should probably do this on my own. You know, you and Mom never know where anything is, so asking you doesn't really help things a bit. If I clean my room a little bit more, I would get to school on time and see my friends a little bit more. And so what happens there with that seemingly irrational question is that Maria begins articulating her own intrinsically motivated reasons for doing something. And one of the key things about persuasion that I learned in looking at the social science is that when, you know, the idea is not to try to flick a switch or manipulate people. It's to create a context where people have their own reasons for doing something. When people have their own autonomous, intrinsically motivated reasons for believing something, they believe it more deeply. When people have their own autonomous, intrinsically motivated reasons for doing something, they do it more vigorously. They adhere to the behavior more enduringly. And so that two-part question on a scale of 1 to 10, how ready are you, and then following up with why didn't you pick a lower number, is a way to get people to come up with their own reasons for doing something.
Now, has this happened where you've asked a question like that and someone has chosen the lowest number? I'm a 1. What is the technique that you follow if somebody says, which I can imagine, I'm a 1?
Yeah, sure. No, that's a good question. So let's say that we go to Maria, and Maria says, I'm a 1, okay? Then the question there is, okay, Maria, you're a 1. What could we do to make it a 2? In those kinds of cases, when people pick a 1, there's usually some kind of barrier, real or imagined, that's preventing them from doing that. And so I say, what can we do to make it a 2? And so Maria might say, oh, well, maybe could you and Mom help me for 15 minutes? Okay, we can do that. And so when people answer or want it, there's usually some kind of structural barrier that you need to identify and move her from a one to a two. What's interesting though, Doug, is that, most people don't answer that one. They actually, they on that question, the 1 to 10 question, you almost always get 2, 3, and 4. You never get a 5 or higher. And every once in a while you get a 1. But usually people who, when you're asking them to do something, they have a little bit more, desire to do it than we might actually think. It's not massive because they're not doing it, but there's some, traces of motivation already there in ways that we often don't realize.
Well, I like that as a very optimistic viewpoint, that there might be traces of motivation in children who aren't cleaning their room. I want to really quickly touch on two other things, because the moment I saw it, I thought of Glengarry Glen Ross, the ABCs, always be closing. You've got a new version of that, of the ABCs for selling in the book, Attunement, Buoyancy, and Clarity. Could you really quickly just give a very brief overview of the new ABCs?
Sure. These are the platform qualities that are necessary in moving others where buyers and sellers are evenly matched. Attunement is perspective taking. Can you get out of your own head, see things from someone else's point of view? Buoyancy is, can you stay afloat in the ocean of rejection that is sales? And C is clarity. Can you move from accessing information to curating it, from solving existing problems to identifying new problems? And these, the social science tells us that these three qualities, attunement, buoyancy, and clarity, really serve the, as a platform for being effective in moving others. Again, whether you're selling automobiles, whether you're selling a group of first graders on doing their assignment, whether you're at home trying to convince your spouse to do something different or do something in a different way.
Okay. Well, Daniel H. Pink, I want to thank you very much for talking to me today about To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. And the surprising truth about Daniel H. Pink, I've just learned, is that you grew up in Columbus, Ohio. And so we're pleased to have you as a native son.
I did. I grew up in Central Ohio. I still bleed scarlet and gray.
Well, thank you very much, sir, and you have a great day.
Thanks so much.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.